The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
Time for Capital Thinking, where we analyze the key policy, political, legal, and business issues that will shape America's future. Live from Washington, D.C., this is your unfiltered tour of the halls of power. Now, here's your host, Kevin O'Neill.
All right, good afternoon, everybody. Good to be back with you this week. We have an interesting show for you. We're going to talk a little bit about the world of renewable energy and electric transmission. Also going to talk about President Obama in a couple of different respects, his ambitious goals to double American exports over the next 5 years, and also the fate of his health care plan. We are going to talk today with former Senate parliamentarian Bob Dove about the complex reconciliation process, what it means for health care reform, and what it means for the rest of the president's agenda in Washington this year. And we'll also hit all of the hot stories of the day from Capitol Hill. But our first guest today is here to talk about electric transmission and renewable energy in a renewable energy transmission conference that he is chairing in Denver, Colorado, and that is attorney Greg Johnson. Greg, welcome to the show. How are you today?
I'm well, Kevin. Thank you so much for the chance to participate.
Well, listen, tell us a little bit about this conference you're chairing on electric transmission and renewable energy and why expanded transmission is so important to the renewable energy world.
Well, thank you very much. The conference is Renewable Energy Transmission, and it's being hosted in Denver on March 18th through the 19th at the Ritz-Carlton. And this is a very important topic, particularly in the West, but really for everyone in our country. Renewable energy, as you may know, isn't necessarily located in places where it has easy access to the grid. Our grid system was constructed and designed many years ago to accommodate a system of electrical distribution, which doesn't reflect the use of distributed generation or renewables. And so we have a tremendous challenge to fully optimize our renewable energy opportunities by reconfiguring the grid to accommodate that. And that's the topic of our conference that's coming up in March.
Very good, and that is there in Denver. Tell us a little bit about why the current grid that's set up doesn't really work for renewable energy.
Sure. As most people know, the history of energy in our country is predicated on the use of major generation facilities, typically coal-fired, but increasingly natural gas or other sources. And it's really kind of a hub-and-spoke system where you have major transmission lines connecting a generation facility to a load center like a city, Chicago or New York or someplace else. And as we move toward renewable energy, we're moving to a system where the point sources for generation are much more widely distributed. Wind farms and solar farms are located, obviously, in places where wind and solar is available to generate energy. And so those places historically have not been where coal-fired plants are. And we need to accommodate that distributed generation system in order to fully optimize the use of renewables.
Very good. Greg, how is the system going to change over time? The president and this administration, this Congress, has a huge appetite for renewable energy, and there have to be a lot of changes that the system has to make in order to accommodate renewable energy on the scale they're talking about.
Well, you're right, and the federal government has been very creative in the approaches it's taken to promote reconfiguration, expansion, and improvement of the grid. There are loan guarantees and grant programs and other forms of federal assistance to help our communities access renewable energy on a more efficient basis. And we've had the pleasure of working with many of the folks who are involved in developing and financing and siting transmission lines in order to accommodate the use of renewables. But it's not just renewables. Our backbone system is, in many cases, inadequate to meet the growing needs for electricity in our country. We've gone from a country that relies relatively less on electrical energy and to a country that relies greatly on electrical energy, as all of us consume more electricity as part of our high-technology society, individuals, businesses, industry. So the challenge to address transmission in our country is multifaceted. It involves improving the capacity of existing major load lines, but also creating a grid system that accommodates, as I've mentioned, distributed generation, wind farms, solar farms located in places that weren't historically served by electrical transmission lines. Some of them are on tribal lands. Many of them are on federal property. And the grid system needs to accommodate that. The federal government is moving in many ways through finance and other assistance, and also as part of the pending energy bills, to create opportunities to more effectively and efficiently develop transmission lines that serve all of our people.
Gotcha. Very interesting. Let's talk a little bit more about the West. I know that they have unique transmission challenges in the western states, purely because of the distance and probably because their infrastructure is much younger than, say, it is in the Northeast or the rest of the country. But tell us a little bit about the challenges that they have for transmission out West.
Well, Kevin, you're absolutely right. Renewable energy is a very big issue in the West. It is viewed as a coming industry for our western states, and as a result, many of the states, probably 9 or 10 by now, have created state agencies, transmission finance agencies, designed to help diversify our energy utilization by financing and otherwise assisting in the expansion and reconfiguration of the grid. Many states, Colorado, New Mexico, Wyoming, other western states, view clean, renewable energy as a high-value export commodity. For a state like New Mexico, where the sun shines and the wind blows, there's the ability to create renewable energy generation facilities to produce power to be sold to Phoenix and Southern California, and that requires a reconfiguration and expansion of the grid in New Mexico. Just by way of example, the state of New Mexico has created the Renewable Energy Transmission Authority, which has been very active in financing the expansion and improvement of transmission facilities in that state so that New Mexico can be an exporter of clean, renewable power. Same is true in Colorado, Wyoming, Utah, Nevada, the Dakotas, Kansas. Many western states view this as a tremendous economic development opportunity as well as something that's good for the country.
All right, great. That's excellent. Well, tell us a little bit about what the federal government's been doing to promote transmission in general.
Well, as I mentioned, they, through the Department of Energy, have taken steps to create loan guarantee and grant programs to assist transmission developers in expanding the current transmission grid. And this has been very critical in the current troubled credit markets. The ability to access capital is essential to address the challenges we face in our grid system. The current credit markets have not been friendly to those who want to develop infrastructure improvements for the future. And the federal government has stepped into the breach through Department of Energy Loan Guarantee and other programs to make it possible for utilities and transmission developers and communities to have an improved and expanded transmission system through these guarantees and other federal programs that make it possible to access the capital markets. And the federal government, through FERC and other federal agencies, is acting to promote the creation of a distributed generation network in our country. Energy is highly regulated in our country. It's very important to our people. And FERC and other federal agencies understand that the future in our nation lies with renewables, and some of the rules and some of the approaches that have been taken in the past that were geared toward coal-fired centralized plants need a reexamination. And it's been our pleasure and privilege to work with our clients to help them secure approvals from FERC and other federal agencies to make this growth and expansion of transmission possible.
Excellent. Well, I've got time for one or two more quick questions. Tell me a little bit about the challenges the private capital markets are having in helping out with improving capacity.
You're absolutely right. There are challenges. All of the participants in our private capital markets today are seeing the holdover of the problems our nation suffered a year or more ago. Capital generally is less available. The odd thing about it is that while interest rates have fallen, the willingness of financial institutions to loan has diminished, and so loan volume is down. And this is particularly true in project financing, where the undertakings in question are many hundreds of millions of dollars. It's not easy to access the credit markets for $500 million transmission project, and particularly so where we're dealing with energy generation facilities that are renewables, which, quite frankly, are somewhat new in the capital markets. There's not necessarily a full appreciation in the capital markets for the opportunities that lie here. And so the federal government has stepped into the breach, as it should, whenever we're dealing with an emerging technology and emerging opportunity, to help jumpstart this opportunity through loan guarantees and other participation. Not, I'm sure, a permanent solution to the problem, but a way to induce the flow of capital, to facilitate renewable energy, and to build an infrastructure that accommodates green energy for our people, and thereby laying the groundwork for the traditional capital markets to continue to function as they have in the past.
Greg, got it. Just about a minute left, so tell people who are interested in finding out more about the conference where they can get that information on the web and where they can get some information if they want to be in contact with you.
I'd be happy to do so. Again, it's the Renewable Energy Transmission Conference. It is held March 18th and 19th at the Ritz-Carlton in Denver. We have a wide selection of participants, experts in the private sector, in the government sector, both at the state and the federal level, people who are experienced in dealing with these problems. I'd be happy to share information with anyone who would like to know more about the conference. My email is gjohnson@pattenbogs.com. My phone is 303-894-6187, and I would encourage anyone who wants more information about this conference to contact me.
Well, Greg, thanks so much. We'll have you back on to talk some more about renewable energy issues later this year. We're going to be back just a moment after this commercial break.
Thank you.
Stocks, bonds, investment opportunities, financial news, and talk. We can help. Call us now toll-free, 866-472-5790. 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
If you find yourself under the Klieg lights of a government investigation, you want experience on your side. Patton Boggs has 46 years of it. We've handled some of the biggest white-collar crime cases. Put that experience to work for you.
Stuart Pape, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-
457-6000. It's all about action.
Touchdown!
Scores.
Taking a look at the NBA tonight.
Highlights.
He's broken loose. He's at the 30.
And headlines.
Big trade in the NFL this afternoon.
When you are looking to talk sports, look no further than the Voice America Sports Network. We bring you some of the biggest names and all the sports news you can handle. Whether it's basketball.
Off the glass.
Football.
Come on.
Football. Golf, racing, or the Olympics. We've got you covered. We'll even cover tailgating. Tune in to the Voice America Sports Network. It's all things sports.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Hear ye, hear ye. The House will come to order.
having trouble sorting out what's going on Capitol Hill? Patton Boggs can cut through it all. We've got the insight, the know-how, the connections to navigate. Patton Boggs, straight, unfiltered. Patton Boggs, a bipartisan voice with knowledge and 46 years of experience.
Stuart Pape, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
Voice America Business Network, the bottom line in business.
Live from Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's K-O-Neill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
Okay, well, we're going to take a look abroad now and talk a little bit about President Obama's agenda and one of his more ambitious goals of doubling American exports over the next 5 years. And joining us whenever we talk about export issues is a lawyer from Northern Virginia who's been on the show before. That's Giovanna Cinelli. Giovanna, how are you today?
I'm well, Kevin. Thank you.
Good. We're glad to have you back on the show. And as I mentioned, the president seems to be intent on pledging to double exports over the next 5 years. Is that a new promise, or is that sort of something that's been repackaged?
A combination of both. It's a repackaging. Since the last couple of presidents have made similar statements regarding the doubling of exports. President Obama has added a timeline, which is a little bit of a different twist. 5 years is certainly an ambitious goal on his part.
Very good. And I know you spend, obviously, your professional time engaged in this area. It's fairly complex. And tell us a little bit about some of the recent developments in laws and regulations that, you know, if I'm the president of Acme Corporation, I might face if I'm deciding to export my widgets abroad for the first time.
You hit the nail on the head. It's a very complicated area because a number of agencies are involved, the State Department, Commerce Department, Defense Department, and Treasury, as well as a number of congressional committees because some of the transitioning exports are going to require congressional notification. So any company new to the area has to familiarize him or herself with a couple of statutes, the Arms Export Control Act, the Export Administration Act, couple of sets of regulations at a minimum, the International Traffic in Arms Regulations and the Export Administration Regulations, as well as the players in all the different agencies I mentioned above, as well as committees such as the House Foreign Relations Committee, the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, the banking committees, who will receive some notifications.
Very good. Giovanna, tell us a little bit about the places where the President Obama and this Congress have consensus on how to handle export requirements and where, even though it's an all-Democratic Congress, I know that there are strong disagreements inside that majority about how to handle some aspects of exports. So tell us a little bit about the areas of consensus and the areas of dissension, if you will.
Sure. And that's a good way to frame the question. This area is fraught with inherent contradictions, and a lot of times the goals that the president may set are impeded by the existing regulations and the existing legislation, and then Congress may have some comparable goals, but when they go to put legislation in place, that's where the disconnect occurs. So, for example, the president has wanted to double exports, but currently Congress has legislatively imposed a licensing regime that looks at each individual transaction for licensing and authorization purposes. That's a tough road to hoe if every time you want to ship your widget overseas, you may have to go to one of the government agencies, submit an application, get it reviewed, which can take weeks and sometimes months, get an approval, and then ship your product. That puts a kink in the timeline the president might be setting to allow for this expansion and growth And right now, the biggest disconnect is this goal is in place, but the laws and regulations Congress and the agencies have passed don't necessarily facilitate that kind of objective.
I see. And I know this, that some of this information is shifting, but talk to me about who the major players are in Congress on export legislation today.
Well, Sander Levin, for example, has just been appointed, and that's going to throw a little bit of a kink as chairman. He's not generally known to be a fan, let's say, of free trade agreements. And to the extent free trade agreements were great facilitators of exporting because there's advantageous aspects of those for both the exporting nation and the importing nation, that's going to be a bit of an obstacle to moving the president's agenda in doubling exports forward over the next 5 years. People are going to be less inclined, perhaps, to sell to an international market if there aren't the same advantages under the free trade agreements. And the recipients as well, if they're going to be facing certain restrictions or cost inefficiencies, are also going to be similarly disincentivized to allow for the exports to occur from the U.S.
Gotcha. So the president's got this ambitious goal. What are some of the tangible steps that his administration has to take in the next couple years to make that pledge of doubling exports a reality? And what obstacles? Surely he's got to clear some legal and regulatory impediments that have been set up by Congress or his predecessors in order to reach that ambitious goal.
Well stated as a question, Kevin. Coordination and cooperation with Congress to outline what legislative changes have to be made is going to be key. The president has taken an ambitious first step by working with Congressman Berman's committee to pull together a new Export Administration Act, which is designed to fundamentally revamp the old approach of transaction-by-transaction licensing. And my understanding is there is legislation being drafted right now and may likely be published within the next couple of weeks. And depending upon how Congress has implemented the president's agenda in that legislation, that can either be a very positive first step or a keep it where it is, so to speak. So we'll have to wait to see the details on that. But that's a coordination, cooperation with Congress is a good first step.
Well, again, sticking with this goal, I mean, how realistic do you think it is that the United States, especially in this economic environment where you don't see a lot of people wanting to invest in new manufacturing capabilities or even lend money to those who do want to do that, that we're going to be able to double our exports abroad over the next 5 years?
I never like to be a naysayer. I do think a fair assessment is this is very ambitious on the part of the president. And for part of the reasons that you named, which is the capital-intensive requirements that are needed to ramp up the manufacturing, to raise those numbers, may not be there, the investment wherewithal. And at the back end, other countries, because of the financial crisis, are facing a lot of the same issues, and they're going to be in the same position, so there may not necessarily be markets that are ready to be export recipients. So I think the two areas, coupled with some of the legal impediments in the form of the statutes and regulations that currently exist, are going to make it an extremely labor-intensive goal for the president to achieve. And again, doubling the exports in a five-year period is truly ambitious.
Gotcha. And what about who are some of these constituencies that are positively impacted by a high-growth export market? And are there actually domestic constituencies that would be negatively affected by a high-growth export market?
You've always got a number of constituencies that may or may not be at odds with each other. You're going to have the labor pool that's going to be interested in expanding manufacturing here in the United States and exporting from the U.S., and so they're going to be interested in trying to get jobs back by expanding. That's going to be intense not only from the labor cost perspective, but, of course, as you mentioned earlier, the facilities that are going to be needed to ramp up to meet this. But you also have a big push amongst the business folks, the non-labor folks, who are seeking to outsource as much as possible because those labor costs are kept down. If they're outsourcing the technology to build overseas, those entities are not going to send the products back to the U.S. and export from the U.S. They're just going to send them directly from the foreign site. So you've got this at-odds position between, let's say, the business folks in a company and the employees who are actually working the assembly lines. They're going to want different things, and that's going to create some potential issues that the president and his team are going to have to address.
Interesting, interesting. What about outsourcing? Is there anything that this will impact, you know, with our race to see American jobs leave our shores, for whether it's a call center in India or other manufacturing facilities in cheaper countries? How will this impact outsourcing?
Well, if the choice is made to invest the money to ramp up production lines, whether they're tangible production lines for product or even intangible, such as the development of more services, whether it's in the IT field or other high-tech fields or consulting services, in order to get the exports coming from the U.S., we should see a decrease in outsourcing. Because if it's outsourced, as I mentioned earlier, nobody's going to outsource the technology, build something overseas, or create it and bring it back to the U.S. to subsequently export it. So you could see, if the goal is implemented correctly, you could see actually a decrease in outsourcing, because there'll be advantages to doing things here in the United States. And that could have a benefit on the economy, the labor situation, and some pretty positive results.
Giovanna, wrapping up, is there one sort of key thing that we'll see happen in the near future that will tip you off as to whether or not we're on pace to meet this goal, the president's?
I think we should expect to see this legislation for the Export Administration Act come out sometime over the next couple of weeks. And because that affects the dual use, those items and technology involving commercial as well as military applications, you're going to see some direction through how that legislation is crafted. And I think that's going to give us some insight into where the president can and perhaps is willing to go.
Very good. Well, Giovanna, why don't you give us your email contact for people who want to follow up with you on export and export control issues?
Thank you. The email is gcinelli@pattenboggs.com. And my phone number is 703-744-8075. And I thank you, Kevin.
All right. Well, we'll have you back some other time to talk about developments in the president's export agenda. We're going to come back in just a minute with a former Senate parliamentarian to talk about the fascinating world of budget reconciliation and what it means for health care reform and the rest of the presidential agenda. Back in a moment.
Whether the market's up or down, or if you're looking to improve your portfolio, our experts are ready to talk to you. Call now, toll free, 866-472-5790. That's 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
What's your name worth? The loss of a single patent, trademark, or copyright can cost millions. Make sure your intellectual property is protected. Trust Patton Boggs to manage and protect your most important assets.
Stuart Pape, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
Joe Cribbs, No Average Joe, is here for you, the fan, to hear about and discuss the week's top stories in the world of sports. We'll discuss not only the headliners, but you'll hear some of the smaller stories that don't usually make it on the sports wires today. It's a forum for the sports fan, hosted by Joe Cribbs, a three-time Pro Bowler with the Buffalo Bills. Joe is a 10-year pro football veteran, a former Southeastern Conference Most Valuable Player, and a member of the Alabama Sports Hall of Fame. Discuss the topics with Joe Cribbs, No Average Joe, Mondays at noon Eastern, 9 a.m. Pacific, on the Voice America Sports Network.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Hola.
Konnichiwa.
Bonjour.
Hello.
From Anchorage to Abu Dhabi.
Marhaba.
From Denver to
Hello.
Doha.
Ciao.
Patton Boggs makes
Nico.
Business transactions
yes.
the world over.
Oi.
Rely on our insights for your next deal. Patton Boggs, the international business team. Straight, unfiltered, Patton Boggs.
Stuart Pape, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
The business community's first choice in Internet Talk Radio. Voice America Business Network.
From Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's koneill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
All right, my political junkie friends, I know you've been studying carefully the process through which we might get health care reform brought into law. Everybody is discussing it. It's the so-called budget reconciliation process. We have with us one of the leading experts on what this process means. Is a gentleman by the name of Bob Dove. Bob had a distinguished 35-year career serving in the United States Senate in a variety of professional roles there, including 13 years in total in two separate stints as the Senate parliamentarian, the person who helps determine the rules of the game, if you will, there in the United States Senate. Now, Bob is a consultant and also a teacher at George Washington University, and I'm sure his classes are packed right now to talk about this. Bob, welcome to Capital Thinking. How are you today?
Well, thank you. It's fun to be here.
Well, Bob, I know you've been making the rounds talking about reconciliation. This is something that was originally designed for deficit reduction, though it occasionally gets wheeled out for other purposes in the past. So tell us how there's a valid argument to be made for using reconciliation today for the president and the majority party to pass comprehensive health care reform.
Well, first of all, reconciliation is probably a misnomer today. It made sense when it was used in the Congressional Budget Act of 1974 because there really was something to reconcile, namely the difference between the appropriations bills and the budget resolution, and the bill to bring those into the same number was called a reconciliation bill. But starting in 1980, it has been used for very different purposes. I think it now should be called the forced march process. And we are going to see an extraordinary use of it in the next few weeks. A first, as it were, as a two-part process, and this has never happened before, involving reconciliation and a bill which is not a reconciliation bill, namely the Senate bill which was passed in December dealing with health care. Now, the simplest way to get a health care bill to the president's desk would be for the House to agree to the Senate language. That would clear the bill for the president, and this would all be over.
Now, Bob, now you're showing your Senate tilt there because your view is that the House should just agree to do whatever the Senate has done.
They normally do, and I don't know why they're being recalcitrant now. But in this case, they certainly are, and they're insisting that the Senate do something that it has the right to do, but in a way that probably will not be clean or neat. And that's to use something called the reconciliation process to force through a bill that will, quote, deal with the problems in the Senate bill. In a sense, that's kind of an insult to the Senate. The Senate probably didn't think there were problems with their bill, and if the House did, they were certainly free to amend that bill. They chose not to do that, and so we're at the situation now where the president has basically called on Congress to use this process called reconciliation to force through with a bare majority changes to the Senate bill. Ironically, cannot be done by the Senate because this is a revenue measure. It has to be done by the House.
I think that's where we really want to delve in with you, Bob, is you know, the House and Senate, you hear a lot in the media about you can do this, you can't do that on reconciliation, and I didn't mean to interrupt your flow of thought there, but can you talk to us a little bit about what can and can't be part of this process? Because I think it's very important substantively to what sort of deal they ultimately work out, isn't it?
Well, I can tell you what you cannot do using this process. You cannot contain provisions that have no budgetary impact. You cannot increase the deficit in the years after the 5-year period of the budget resolution. You must reduce the deficit by the amount that was instructed, which is not very much, frankly, a total of $2 billion. But also, you cannot have provisions which, even if they are palpably budgetary in nature and actually do change the figures in the budget, are there not for that reason, but for policy reasons. That's the most difficult test that the parliamentarian has to apply. It's the test that I applied when I was parliamentarian in 1995 to throw out a provision which would have prevented the federal government from financing abortions. I thought that was there not to save money, although it would have, but there to implement a social policy, and it was stricken.
Well,
that's
that seems
what
to
the
be
parliamentarian is going to be doing over the coming weeks, going through provision by provision, trying to decide what is in order under that provision.
Yeah, I know abortion is one of the touchstones yet again in this process. Now, obviously, the point of reconciliation is to do by 51 what can't be done by 60, and to avoid the whole notion of a filibuster in the Senate. But I hear conflicting things, Bob, about what the rights of the minority, the Republicans in this case, are to offer amendments and sort of help dictate the terms of the debate and, most importantly, the length of the debate before we actually get to a vote if reconciliation is the vehicle. So talk to me a little bit about that.
Well, they can't change the terms of debate. Debate is limited to 20 hours. But that is not anything like the Senate's cloture rule, which has a 30-hour period in which everything is included. There are lots of things that are not included in that 20 hours. For example, votes on amendments are not included. Quorum calls before votes are not included. The time for reading of amendments is not included. And there is no limit on the number of amendments. So even after the 20 hours of debate has expired, as long as people want to write out amendments, they can send them to the desk and get votes on them, and that could extend this by some time.
And I know the Senate works on consensus, and we're going to, you know, typically there's an agreement on how long we'll consider this bill and that bill. It's fair to say that there's probably not going to be consensus here where Republicans would agree to limit time, so that can they effectively filibuster this process through the
offering? Well, I wouldn't use the term filibuster, but they can certainly delay it. And no, I don't think there's going to be any consensus on the use of reconciliation for health care reform. Just to the contrary. This is going to be war.
It already feels like it is. Now, one of the things in terms of these amendments, I know most people will focus on health care amendments, but is there often in Washington, especially in the Senate, we talk about germane amendments and non-germane amendments. Is there any limit to the scope of what I could offer as an amendment to the health care bill to keep the debate going?
Well, there absolutely is a limit, but frankly, that doesn't matter very much because the practice in the Senate in this kind of situation is to offer amendments that may be absolutely and totally non-germane and not in order, and then make a motion to waive the Budget Act to permit those amendments, and then there's a vote. And that is the objective of the person offering the amendment, not to win, but to force senators to vote on really embarrassing things. And my reaction is there will be a lot of those amendments.
Can you give us an example of what you would consider to be one of those gotcha-type amendments?
Well, I'm sure there will be amendments dealing with closing Guantanamo Bay, with trying terrorists in New York, just every hotbed issue you can think of. I'm sure there will be an amendment, and then a forced vote. Not that they will win, but they will get senators on the record on that issue.
I see, and use that in the upcoming campaign season, for example.
Absolutely. That's why they're doing it.
Interesting. Now, one of the other things that gets very complicated is this so-called Byrd Rule, which I know interacts with reconciliation and the parliamentary process in the Senate in general. Can you explain to us in a way that the average person can understand what the Byrd Rule is and why it matters in this debate?
Well, the Byrd Rule was created in the mid-'80s because the reconciliation bills, which had passed from 1980 to 1985, had contained numerous provisions that had nothing to do with the budget. And it was Senator Robert Byrd who proposed that the rule should be changed to avoid that. And since that period, you can make discrete points of order against any provision in any reconciliation bill which has no budgetary effect, or for which the budgetary effect is outweighed by the policy effect.
Interesting. So I guess give me an example of, in the past, of how the Byrd Amendment has impacted Senate debate on something important.
Well, I can remember on the 1995 bill, there was a provision that would have allowed physicians to totally avoid the antitrust statutes and form little groups that supposedly were going to save money in health care. It was my view, as parliamentarian at the time, that avoiding the antitrust statutes for physicians was much more of a policy issue than a budgetary issue, and my advice was that that was not in order and that provision was stricken.
Interesting. Now, Bob, one of the things I know got you in the news this week was talking about the vice president's role in all this. You called him the ultimate decider on what the rules of reconciliation actually are. Can you explain the vice president's role as a tie-breaking vote in the Senate and what he can do in the reconciliation battle?
Well, I think that's gotten a great deal more attention than it deserved. I did point out, and it's accurate, that the vice president of the United States is the ultimate presiding officer of the Senate, and he doesn't have to pay attention to advice from the parliamentarian. And I've actually seen a vice president who, in very important issues, totally ignored the advice of the parliamentarian. That vice president was Hubert Humphrey. But I've not seen any vice president since then do that. And basically what has happened, and this has started with the Carter administration, when President Carter gave the vice president an office in the West Wing, is that vice presidents have disappeared from the Senate. They no longer play a role in the Senate. I would be very surprised if Vice President Biden played any role at all in this process.
Interesting. Bob Dove, fascinating conversation about reconciliation. I promise you we want to have you back on because I think this is going to be a process that plays out for a couple more months despite the president's desire for a present on his desk by Easter Sunday. Bob, thanks for joining us. We're going to be back in just a minute with the latest news from Capitol Hill. Stay here for more after this break.
Whether the market's up or down, or if you're looking to improve your portfolio, our experts are ready to talk to you. Call now, toll free, 866-472-5790. That's 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
From K Street to Wall Street to LaSalle Street, the Patton Boggs team knows how to pull off big business transactions. Come hear what we know. Patton Boggs covers the world.
Stuart Pape Attorney at Law is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs Principal Office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Interrogatories.
Prima facie.
Pleadings.
Motion for summary judgment.
E-discovery.
Affirmative defense.
Stipulations.
Ex parte.
Amicus brief.
Subpoena.
Litigation is confusing. Trust the litigation team at Patton Boggs to make sense of it all.
Stuart Pape Attorney at Law is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs Principal Office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
The same firm that's been navigating the government maze for more than four decades is also the same firm that can help you protect your most important assets. Whether it's a valuable patent, an important copyright, or your next big idea, Patton Boggs is committed to protecting your intellectual property.
Stuart Pape Attorney at Law is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs Principal Office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network. From Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's K-O-Neill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
All right, welcome back. Well, it is almost March Madness time in the nation. It's already March Madness time in Washington, D.C., I can tell you, with what's going on Capitol Hill and at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. Before we talk about that, I do want to talk about the basketball tournament, though, because my Syracuse Orangemen ranked number one for the first time in 20 years. Very excited about that. Season and coming out of nowhere, not unranked at the beginning of the year, now the nation's number one team, looking at a number one bid perhaps to the big dance. And I have a promise from my wife that we get to go to the Final Four if the Orangemen make it, so I am definitely looking forward to that opportunity. Missed their last trip to the Final Four a few years ago, and therefore very hopeful and very excited about next weekend when March Madness kicks off, when all the conference tournaments kick off, and then March Madness just a couple weeks behind it. But as I said, March Madness in full swing here in D.C., guys. For those of you who don't read it, I highly recommend an email that comes out every morning from ABC News called The Note that summarizes sort of the political conventional wisdom of the day and highlights top stories in leading newspapers and television reports around the country. They had an excellent analysis this morning that said, what if this election was like 2006? There's been a lot of comparisons saying that this political season might be like 1994 when Republicans took back the House. But their analysis this morning was, what if it's like 2006? Do you remember just 4 years ago when Nancy Pelosi, the minority leader, helped sweep Democrats to power in the House of Representatives by claiming Republicans had headlined a culture of corruption and that Washington was a swamp of dubious ethical activity that needed to be drained? Well, ABC News' point was that the shoe is now on the other foot, and Speaker Pelosi is facing a number of ethical issues with her members that could cause that to be a central point in the Republican efforts this fall to retake the House. You saw in just the last couple of days, Chairman Charlie Rangel of the most powerful committee in the House of Representatives, the Ways and Means Committee, does all the tax writing legislation and must initiate there in the House, forced to take a leave of absence from the committee after being admonished by the House Ethics Committee recently for some travel he took that was sponsored by corporations in violation of the ethics rules. Rangel didn't want to leave. and the Speaker wasn't anxious to push him out for a variety of very intriguing political reasons. But what happened was the Speaker discovered that she didn't have the votes to keep him in office. Congressional Republicans were going to introduce what's called a privilege resolution, which would require a vote on the House floor to strip Rangel of his chairmanship. That would have put all the Democrats on the spot to vote for him or against him after he'd been admonished by the Ethics Committee. The Speaker was on record several years ago saying that the House Majority Leader at that time, Tom DeLay, should step down from his leadership position after he was admonished by the Ethics Committee. And so she was having trouble explaining the difference between that, which she condemned a few years ago, and that which she seemed to be condoning in keeping Rangel in his position today. And what happened was vulnerable Democrats, especially freshmen, sophomores, younger Democrats from districts that John McCain has carried or that are Republican-leaning in nature, went to the Speaker and let her know, we're gonna have to vote to take Chairman Rangel out of this office. Once it became clear the votes weren't there, he stepped down, and he's taken a leave of absence, hoping the Ethics Committee will clear him of some other issues before too long passes by and he can assume his position. Although I think it's probably more reasonable to think that he will never get back to the chairmanship. In the last 2 days, there's been a fascinating fight over the chairmanship. Initially passed on a temporary basis to Pete Stark, a very liberal member from the San Francisco Bay Area. And interestingly enough, there was an internal Democratic revolt from the members of that committee saying, we don't want Stark as our chairman, even though he's the most senior guy and has the right to assume this position. We don't want him as the chairman. We're worried about where that might lead. And so in just the last couple hours, and Giovanna mentioned this in our segment earlier, Sander Levin of Michigan has been appointed to be the chairman of Ways and Means. He is someone who's very closely aligned with interests in Michigan, especially the auto industry, and therefore it could really change the ballgame on issues like free trade agreements that might be negotiated with countries like Korea and Colombia that are pending in the United States right now and need approval. So very interesting. The Speaker has a number of ethical challenges to deal with in her membership. There's a young member from the state of New York, Eric Massa, who has announced his retirement in the last 24 hours, saying that he had a recurrence of cancer, and we certainly hope he gets better. But coming on the heels of that was also an announcement that he's now under investigation from the Ethics Committee, perhaps in conjunction with reports that he made some unwanted advances on a member of his staff. If you go back to 2006, again, referencing what ABC's The Note said, that channels 2006 when Republicans were in a lot of political trouble, and then one of the straws that broke the camel's back was the whole issue involving Congressman Mark Foley and his relationship with congressional pages, and will Congressman Massa's allegations against him involving his staff, will that be the sort of thing that breaks the camel's back here? It's going to be a very interesting question. And, of course, all these ethical dilemmas really undermine public confidence in Washington. We already see Congress at abysmal, historically low approval ratings in public opinion polls. And the events of the last few days, whether or not you're Republican or Democrat, they're not going to give you a lot of faith that these are the people that we want to fix the problems that we have. And it reinforces the notion that these folks aren't spending time focusing on my problems. They're spending time on themselves. And that's a dangerous notion for the people in Congress, that they've got to convince the American people they're out there working for their own good. Now, I do want to relay one quick story on health care reform. I spent some time up on the Hill this week and been in both Republican and Democratic offices. Certainly still a lot of trouble with the House and the Speaker finding the votes she needs to pass health care reform under reconciliation. I'm not sure that she has them there today. Meanwhile, in the Senate, the minority party seems to be gearing up for war. Bob Dove mentioned this earlier on, but I think their position is that the president faces an either-or choice. If he jams through health care reform using the budget reconciliation process, then Republicans may resign themselves to using all of their procedural objections to everything else that might come up for the rest of the year. They may basically choose to shut the Senate down for the remainder of 2010 and hold out hope that they can use the election to turn the tide on the balance of power in both chambers, because they will be so ticked off that healthcare reform will have passed by this unprecedented process. So that's going to be very interesting to watch. If it does go through, what will be the reaction? What will be the impact on other major items in the Obama agenda? Is this all he might get done this year? And if so, is it a worthy trade-off for the president? I think that's going to be a question that he and his staff are grappling with in the next few weeks. We'll see you next week with more Capital Thinking. Have a great weekend.
Thank you for joining us for Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. We hope to have you join us again for more insight from Washington. We're here every Thursday at 9 a.m. Pacific Time, noon Eastern, on the Voice America Business Network.